small way to what gathered here are, you know, trying to sort of make a claim to a public space, city property, as a place to actually talk about something rather than just a place to pay your parking. We're also being broadcast live on the radio and being recorded. And that report is going to end up on a website. So that's generally what we're doing. More specifically, the conversation today is about technology and democracy. This is a very big topic, obviously. And so I invited a few people who whose work is somehow intersected with this topic to come today. When I was thinking about it, I wrote a little blurb that I can read to get us started. Digital technologies promise greater accessibility of the information and open debate vital to a democratic society, as well as advocacy groups like Move On or Working Families leap to prominence and help millions email on a range of issues. But increased information doesn't necessarily enhance a capacity to understand, and a greater volume of emails to the White House, for instance, seems to mean each one counts for less and less. Recent headlines are filled with concerns over the security of electronic voting machines, and political campaigns have begun using demographic and marketing data to craft their messages and choose who hears what. Concerns over data mining as emphasis on not that might complicated ways, and understanding and negotiating those complexities will be a major task for those who want to speak, be heard, and to hear others. How their work intersects with the topic. And then I have a few little seed questions which I sort of throw out to get us started, but it may be that what people are working on, they might want to add, and what questions they might want to ask other people. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
Charlie, I'm going to get a sound. Charlie, can you hear? No, honk if you can hear all of us. Okay.
Oh, no one else is speaking.
Yeah, I think, but we pass this around to get a little bit better sound. So, I've introduced.
We do a, just like a go around sound check.
I think it's going to be okay. I can increase the levels later on, too.
Okay.
So I'm going to pass the mic around for people to introduce themselves in their work. If you ask me, don't want to.
Hi, I'm Dave. And there's actually three things that I spend all my, you know, time on that are all relevant to this discussion. One is that I'm a grad student in philosophy, and my project that I'm working on has to do with the nature of political legitimacy, and the particular theory I'm trying to work out says something like political legitimacy doesn't come from agreement about what we ought to do, but from the fact that we're engaged in an ongoing conversation that we all agree to be in that conversation as far as we agree to anything. And so that's where I think political legitimacy comes from. So if that's right, then to have a legitimate state and legitimate laws, you need to have public spaces where people talk about this. And one of the things I'm interested in doing is kind of redefining what counts as political as well. People think it has to do with, you know, who's the president, but I think it has to do with things like that, sure, but also like, you know, where do you shop? What are just the daily things in your life? So I think politics goes all the way down, and that's just in my academic work, that's what I think. I'm also a, an activist, which probably most of the people here are, and mostly through the Graduate Employees Organization, but also I've helped with other things when people have asked us to, which I'll talk about in just a second. And as an activist, I'm interested in getting voices that aren't heard, so I'm interested in that. And the last thing is, just in the last couple of months, I started a blogger, and a couple of friends of mine have a weblog that a bunch of us contribute to, and something that I did a couple of weeks ago, I went in with the people who took over the Swanland Administration Building, and I used Swanland's wireless network to weblog the whole event, as we were going through it, and we in the course of 2 days, like 10,000 hits nation from people who were following the story, and you know, that definitely ties right into this. So those are the three things that make me interested in this conversation.
I'm Ben, and I read Dave's blog while he was on the inside of Swanland Administration Building, and I was 800 miles away in Washington, D.C., where I spend most of my time these days. I'm also a grad student in communications. I work sometimes in the U.S. Congress. I work sometimes for media reform groups. And I have a very good story that will start off the conversation later after we've been around the circle that happened today, that is possibly the most outrageous thing I've heard about the media and democracy this year. I'm Victor. I'm a graduate student in the Institution for Communications Research, Institute for Communications Research at the University of Illinois. And I also read Dave's blog on this side. It's pretty cool. As far as my activist concerns go, I've been involved with indie media and also what we refer to as media democracy movement in Seattle for the last several years. Definitely involved with what might be called the media reform movement now. As much as possible, I try to merge my activist and academic interests. As far as my activist concerns go, I've been involved with indie media and also what we refer to as media democracy movement in Seattle for the last several years. And I'm definitely involved with what might be called the media reform movement. As much as possible, I try to merge my activist and academic interests. And two areas that I'm working on right now that I think involve the intersection of technology and democracy would be studying the development of communication systems, studying the history and the ways in which communication policies get formed. And the other area that I think is probably more relevant to this discussion would be looking at the democratic applications of internet technology, and that's something that I'm sure we'll talk about, especially the radical democratic applications of technology.
My name's Danielle Shenowith, and I have kind of three levels in which I work that are relevant to today's discussion. One is I work in the sister building to this building over in Urbana. I serve on Urbana's city council. And I represent Ward 4 in Urbana, which is primarily professors, academic professionals, and graduate students, almost overwhelmingly. And the primary way in which I communicate with my constituents is via email. I have an e-newsletter and a lot of email correspondence. And I have some really interesting observations about ways in which people communicate and participate in politics over email, and how that's different than when they come in and they speak in City Hall, and how that's also different than when they come and speak in my house. And those three arenas being such the same people, the same ideas, extremely different ways of speaking and relating to one another. The second way is I work at OJC Technologies as a web developer, and I work both for activist organizations and activist organizations, academic environments, and nonprofits, building, basically trying to develop tools for them to communicate to their constituencies. So I have some background in that. And then I have been intensely involved with the Independent Media Center in Urbana, and particularly involved in radio production. I'm also on the web team there. And so really interested in the way in which our radio group has come to use the internet as a way to gather material and post material, and the sharing of audio information on the web, and the way in which I'm able to get audio information from, say, radio groups in Guatemala posted by people who don't know how to write but who are producing radio, that I can then have translators translate and can put into a local story about, say, not yet legal immigrants in our town. So the ways in which this medium kind of allows us to kind of pull this material from all over the world, and the ways in which especially radio and the internet intersect to create a really democratizing space for media. So, and I'm sick today, so I'll stumble through as I can.
I'm George Carlisle, and some of my activism locally is mostly by writing letters to the editor of the newspaper. You can hear all the cars roaring in the background, and Champaign-Urbana has a growing traffic problem. I would like to see an electronic solution to that, similar to the I-Pass on the turnpikes that allows you to go through the toll gates without actually having to pay. We need something like that here in Champaign-Urbana and have differential time of day rates. It's rush hour right now, and traffic is really intense going north on Walnut Street, the one-way street that forks from Neal Street a block south, and there are just so many cars going on the street. The few buses that are running are practically empty, maybe 4 or 5 passengers on them. Problem is we don't have frequent enough service to lure more people away from their own cars. And I shudder to think what will happen when our supply of petroleum is exhausted. We need more technology to develop alternative fuels and supply of petroleum. The rate we're going seems like it can't last more than another 20 or 30 years. I'll pass the mic on to the next person.
Well, I'm Sasha Meinrad, and I've just been handed today's weekly newspaper, and the wireless project that I've been coordinating for the last 3 years is in here, which I didn't know was going to happen at all. It's kind of interesting. I'm getting pressed and we're not actually even involved in it for once. Mainly I'm involved academically in ICR as a graduate student. Just gotten to sign off on my master's thesis in psychology. Thank Christ.
Thought you were Jewish.
And let's see, what else am I involved with? Indie Media, both as treasurer for the Global Indie Media Network, so when disbursements are made, I tend to know the different projects that are happening there, and as a member here of the local independent, very involved these days more in governance and web stuff a little bit, and a little bit of shows, but mainly just the financial aspects. And then as a founder of a development company, a software development company, and a member of another tech collective, an international tech collective, I guess at this point, where all of the work we do is open source, and we only work for activist clients. To me it's very interesting, actually, to be trying to find ways to merge all of these different elements of life, so that I can have a little bit of time at least for personal life. I'm interested in how, like, these ideas of public space and technology and communications not only facilitate communication and a public space, but also private spaces. I've definitely been fighting that along the way. So maybe I'll just pass this back to Sarah and we can take it from there.
Okay, well, would anyone have an objection to hearing the story that we had so tantalizingly dropped in our lap?
Good story. This is what happened. So, many of you, probably like myself, don't watch network television on a regular basis. But apparently, on Friday nights, is ABC's long-running news show called Nightline, hosted by Ted Koppel, one of the nation's most respected journalists. And Nightline is chosen on Friday night to run a program. Instead of doing their usual news magazine or newsmaker interviews, Ted Koppel is simply going to read the names one by one of the men and women who've been killed in Iraq as a part of the United States military forces there, as a public memorial and as a statement that this is news which is repeated in statistics in the daily papers every day, but is not necessarily felt by the American people at the level of gravity that it ought to be. Now, no matter how we may feel about a spectacle of military casualties, no matter how we may feel about the war in Iraq, the this is ABC News' decision as a product of their ongoing effort to inform the American public. Now then, the Sinclair Broadcasting Group, which is a second-tier media company that owns 62 television stations around the country, including 8 stations which are ABC affiliates in places like St. Louis, Missouri, Columbus, Ohio, Charleston, West Virginia. The Sinclair Broadcasting Group yesterday released a press release saying that they're tired of the left-wing bias in the media and Sinclair would like their stations to become the next Fox, to return a fair and balanced reporting method to the American media. Today, Sinclair released a press release saying that they are going to require their 8 ABC affiliate block the transmission of Ted Koppel's Nightline on Friday night because they think that ABC is doing that for political reasons to undermine the effort, the war effort in Iraq, and as an insidious attempt to politically damage the president during his re-election. Furthermore, they said, if you don't believe us, all you have to do is look at Ted Koppel's coverage of 9/11. Why didn't he have shows where he sat and read through the list of names of the victims that died in the terrorist attacks in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? So we're forcing all 8 of our stations that are affiliated with ABC not to carry Nightline. ABC responded by saying, "We object to your decision." Basically, decided for 8 large network affiliates in places that serve millions of Americans in other states across the country that they would not be permitted to see this material on ABC News. And the of Sinclair said that, in their opinion, what Ted Koppel was going to do was not in the public interest. And it was their responsibility to determine what was the public interest, and therefore they determined not to allow that broadcast to go
through. And I had one local thing to this. A couple of months ago, Al Sharpton hosted Saturday Night Live. Our local station didn't broadcast it. They broadcast a repeat Saturday Night Live from several months before. And just to... So this isn't, like, new or uncommon or not. Something that goes on here.
So there's been a really instant backlash. Letters have been circulating around the Congress, particularly amongst the Progressive Caucus. People saying, you know, it's one thing to preempt entertainment... When it's very common conservative for local stations to preempt something like, you know, a raunchy episode of The Bachelor, because they think that their local market won't appreciate that, and a local station manager makes that decision. It's a totally different thing when you start preempting a news broadcast, and when the corporate headquarters decides to starts deciding what's news for the American people and what's not, and there is no recourse. Despite the fact that these companies have a business that operates by our leave, they operate because we allow them to use our broadcast airwaves. There's nothing we can do, and they can continue to do this as long as they like, until they become the next Fox, if that's their ambition. The only thing that we can do is every 8 years we have the opportunity to object that their license not be renewed. And never in the history of broadcasting has a license been revoked by the federal government for any reason. Including KKK rallies being broadcast on a channel in Kentucky about 30 years ago. So I'll toss that out into the middle for a general discussion about how people feel.
It's not just what is new. First of all, I'm completely appalled hearing the story. It's not that it's new. It's not just making news. It's deciding that reading the names of American soldiers who have died, and the one, you know, being paid very low wages, by the way, compared to the, you know, mercenaries who are now being hired to do similar kinds of work, that somehow that is considered leftist or biased news and not in the public interest. So I think there's, you're kind of looking at it one step above the way I hear it, which is, yes, ABC is determining what is news. Well, they do that all the time. They constantly determine what is news, what is not news, or the Sinclair Group. But the Sinclair Group would actually preempt something, and preempt something that I think is right in line with Bush's prohibiting media to be on the base when bodies come back in what is now called transfer tubes. They're no longer called body bags, they're called transfer tubes. So the transfer tubes come back sanitized and, you know, the media is not allowed to be there. And I think that my first reaction to hearing that is that I want to go to the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the place in downtown, what's the place called, the American Legion, and actually put a poster up about this issue on both of them, because those are the people I really want to know about that, and they're not going to know because they're the ones who watch ABC. They'll only get the consequences of it. They won't actually receive the story about the battle, the pitch battle. And one of the issues that comes up in that I'll, and then I will yield the floor, but one of the issues that comes up in that is exactly when the media, such as Sinclair Group, media owners, make decisions like that, there's the question of who's the person talking about the media. You know, the media is the kind of aboutniks about everything else. They're constantly abouting everything else. But who are the people, you know, by what means do we actually have a conversation, a national conversation about the media itself and the decisions that it makes? And right now it seems like that decision is very much online, so it reaches a certain constituent base. It won't reach the people who actually, I think, the veterans of foreign wars and the pro-military folks who would be appalled by a story like that.
I like what you just said, because I want to try to weave the notion of technology and the media together and think about technology as a tool which is used both to enforce decisions like that and then usually to counter them. That I imagine most of the response they've gotten so far is via email, via national activist alerts that only very certain people would be on. And I think in any kind of consideration of technology and democracy, the double-edged uses of certain technologies has got to be something that we consider.
Well, I actually watch Nightline most nights, because I actually it's pretty typical for me to turn on my television at about 10:34 and watch Nightline, and that'd be the time I turn it on. And it's not a good show, but they actually, one of the things they have is at the end of every broadcast they do identify the names of the war dead that they have the names of, because they don't release the names immediately. And I have my morning ritual is I get up and I turn on my computer and check my email, and I turn on NPR and I listen to all this stuff. And the first thing I heard on NPR was that 10 Americans had been killed in Iraq yesterday and overnight. Basically, since I'd gone to bed, 10 Americans had been killed in Iraq. And, you know, that information does get spread via the web, and not by sites that are obviously leftist. There's a cost of war site, which has, which is a leftist slant on the casualties, but there's also a right-wing site, and I'm forgetting the name of the site, that is very much it's about patriotism and how great these guys are who have given their lives for the country. Yeah, it's on the total side. But both sides, and it's the right wing site that actually gives names and pictures and things like that. And what I'm interested in is, I mean, I see those sites, but I guess there's something more powerful about having it done on Nightline. I don't really know what it is. And so
I think that when there's an image attached to it, it becomes a spectacle. It becomes a performance of mourning, where if it's text on a screen, there's a certain flatness to it, and it's merely information.
Do you think it's the simultaneity of the fact that with Nightline, you kind of know that there's millions and millions, probably hundreds of millions of people are watching that all at the same time, having a certain experience, whereas on the web it's much more happenstance. I wonder if that's
that occurred to me. Yeah, I don't know what to say about it, but it's they are hyping this Nightline thing that they've decided to do. They've been promoting it, not just on Nightline, but in the press, which I've only seen online, but in the press, since, the weekend, it's been there. So they clearly want people to know it's going to happen, and they want people to tune in. I mean, so I guess the undercurrent is, I guess we're talking about, in some sense, you know, what you can do through alternative media sources, especially maybe web-based, things like that. And maybe what this raises is that they're limited. They just, because they don't have the reach, there are going to be kind of built-in limits. And I don't know where else that goes, but that's...
Well, trying in thinking about this, we have several things that are layered on top of each other right now. We've got technologies that enable that form of censorship to happen. We have the consolidation that enables that form of censorship to happen. And we have, on the other hand, an explosion or proliferation of sources of information that are always there someplace else, someplace not here. And this interplay of incredible consolidation and an absolute explosion and just emptiness at the locality or sort of a unity in an individual place seem like they're all things that are furthered by technology, and some of those seem like they're desirable and some of them seem like they're not desirable. And I'm kind of curious about moving a little bit from the specificity of the news story and the news of Nightline and trying to think about some of the structures involved and where people who might want to interfere or intervene in those undesirable parts might be able to use or amplify the desirable ones.
Just one thing I want to add. I mean, I think that's right. That's what's going on. But also, what I want to say is that the strengths of each system, network, whatever, are tied into the weaknesses. I mean, the network news can be censored and controlled at a very high level, but that's because it is so consolidated and all this, but it's also because it's so consolidated and has such reach that it's able to have the particular kind of power that it does. At the same time, these distributed networks are more likely, well, I don't know if more likely to be true, but there's certainly room for a broader range of opinions. And that has to do with the fact that they're not centrally controlled and consolidated. But this also limits the impact that any one of them can have, maybe. That's
centralization, though, is a double bind. It's just spinning out from where we started. How is this story reported? Of course, it's the 24-hour news cycle. The story, the press releases came out late in the morning. It's not going to be on any television news program probably ever at all. Unless it's on ABC and they use it to hype the Nightline show.
Are you talking about the About story?
The Sinclair censorship.
Where did you get that story?
It was first reported on a weblog by a guy named Jim Romanesco, who's a former journalist who works for the Poynter Institute. And then the Center for American Progress picked it up and started whipping around sort of the left-wing journalist crowd and press secretaries in Washington. And then letters started going around inside the Congress, among members of Congress, and then Bloomberg picked it up. It's now on the wires, and maybe it will be in the major papers tomorrow. But here's the rub that I'm trying to get to is the numbers of people who watch a network program. Like if you look at the top 50 programs on television in terms of the raw numbers of people who are watching them, the first cable show comes in at like number 45. So when you think about, is the internet a comparable news source in terms of the impact it can have on public opinion, the impact it can have on public information? It's just a tiny sliver by comparison with this monolithic broadcast power, which, you know, is at its lowest, it's at its lowest point in years. So, in a sense, what we need, if we're going to counter a group like Sinclair that decides that they're going to centralize news and they're going to politicize it. If news is going to be overtly political, then it's necessary to have a counterpoint. But if your counterpoint is decentralized and inchoate, and a website here, and a website here, and a blog here, and a blog here, and if you're not connected to those, you never know about it, and all you get is the newspaper version, the television version. So there are lots of arguments to say we need dense decentralized media, but if we don't have a centralized source where people can go and trust that they're getting good information, can we ever hope to create a level playing field?
I just
want to
throw a question out there. This is not one that I have an answer to, but one of the questions that I would have to that is, do we really want to create any kind of centralized structure where people know what, or automatically trust the source? I think one of the things that is potentially good, potentially helpful about democracy and the internet is precisely that it's not trustworthy, and that people might be encouraged, because it's untrustworthy, to do a little bit of digging. However, I definitely hear what you're saying, and I'm actually surprised by that statistic of how continuing influence and relevance broadcast news has for so many people. I think that's something that, you know, as a very bunch of privileged people here, it's really easy to lose track of.
Sure. Let's see, my first instinct is to sort of step back into the abstract for a second, because we're talking about how we evaluate technology, and I agree, I think the theme here is that we evaluate it according to how it's used, and I think it's wrong to approach technology by saying that it's entirely neutral. I mean, we only have to think about nuclear bombs, landmines, even barbed wire as examples of technology that certainly have sort of a malintent, but yet we also know that there are always unintended consequences with technology. And this question of do we centralize or decentralize, I think is an example of this, excusing the military metaphor, but I think we have to sort of fight a two-front war with this. On one hand, we have to try to develop decentralized alternative models. And a great example is indie media, which is sort of a form of a radical democratic technology. But at the same time, and I think we have a great example of this with MoveOn, which you begin to see strategic re-centralization. MoveOn is definitely, aside from mobilizing over a million people through its powerful email lists, it's also able to sort of contest the mainstream messages that come out, and it sounds like that's what you're kind of referring to. Like, there's no way we can compete with Fox News with a constellation of blogs, even though this left-wing blog sphere is growing, and arguably some messages do leak into the mainstream media. Oftentimes, the Trent Lott story is tried out as an example of where something that originated in the blogosphere eventually became primetime news and had tremendous effects on the political landscape. But I think we're just beginning to see the early formation of this. And I think it's also interesting to compare the indie media radical democratic model with the MoveOn liberal model of democratic access of internet technology. Well, I think we can first of all think of media as like an example of a technological system. So that's kind of a nice way of thinking of it, at least on an abstract level. But that is something that interests me, and I think comparing those two models, where with indie media you have a very radical democratic model where it's clear that the agenda is to level all power hierarchies, to change the production process so that we all can become media producers. On the other hand, and it's often focused very much on a micro level, which can also be very strategic, but looking at MoveOn, we have more of sort of a macro level of a democratic model that's based more on sort of a liberal understanding of how the political process works, kind of a pluralistic view where you've got competing interests in society, and you can say that
move on is harnessing or giving voice to a particular voice, a particular interest group that heretofore had been somewhat neglected in the mainstream political process. But at the same time, even though MoveVine's slogan is democracy in action, you could argue that it's not a very grassroots-based model. Most of the decision is top-down. Most of the decision-making is top-down, whereas obviously with Indie Media, it's consensus-based. So those are just some ideas, but perhaps a provocative argument with that is that, especially given today's state of affairs, the MoveVine model is much more politically effective. And, you know, I mean, they have different aims, and we should always try to cultivate a diversity of tactics, but... So anyway, I don't know how helpful it is to compare those two models further, but those are examples of different applications of the same technology.
I want to add to what Victor's saying to give another model of, besides Indie Media, that maybe is gives you a different picture, because sometimes you think of Indie Media and you think of the Newswire, and the Newswire is just a mishmash of stuff, and it's really difficult to find things, and in that way it's not as successful, so to speak, as a MoveVine. But I want to put a different model in the picture of what you're talking about, and that is Free Speech Radio News. And Free Speech Radio News, as far as I know, has never existed before. And here's the model that I think is so captivating to me. Let me counterpoise it to BBC. So BBC World News is like BBC's all over the world. So they like send their correspondents out, and the correspondents with their little British accents talk about, well, yeah, yakety yak, and I saw this and I saw that, you know, back to you in London. So that's like, you know, that's generally the international radio model. Free Speech Radio News goes out and trains people, primarily women, oftentimes women, in countries all over the world who are engaged in political struggles, who are somehow connected to or reflecting on, or so they have a set of contacts, whether they're an activist themselves or someone who's interested in commentating on, having commentary on activists, they're connected to it, and then they send in reports, and every day for a half an hour, you hear 5-minute segments from all over the world in so many different accents of all these different people, this kind of grassroots, but then it's all sent to Free Speech Radio News, and then it's distributed to the affiliates. And so I think that's a little bit of a different model that I feel is, because I'm very wary of the centralized model. And MoveOn.org, whenever I hear them, I know they sign it. They say, and this and that, and Jane, and, you know, it used to be just guys, and then I noticed there were a few women in there, and then, you know, now it's like eight folks. And so I basically have an essential distrust with MoveOn.org, even though I do think they do such wonderful things, that their reputation is based on what they've said and what they've proven, but I don't appreciate the centralized model of doing things. I just have one other comment, which is that the future of media, like kind of the healthy future I see of like media consumption, is this very layered, diverse media consumption model. And I think it actually isn't new. It used to be the case that in towns just like Champaign and Urbana, there would be many different ways to get your media. And in that case, it was usually print media and radio. And, you know, and then there was this consolidation effort, and I feel like there's this diversification effort, and I feel like most young people that I know, especially middle class, but not exclusively middle class, are really getting their information from many different layers, and that the older folks I know really just rely on the network still. And so what I notice, and this is very interesting, is in one neighborhood, you know, when I'm sitting downtown, my body may be 100 feet away from another body in a different room, in a different office, and what they're consuming in terms of media is completely different than what I'm consuming in terms of media, mostly because of this generational gap. But I think that what teenagers and 20 and 30-somethings are doing in terms of media consumption will be the next stage. And I think it's healthy.
This is a really important question about the applications of data gathering and analysis tools that are also technologically driven, which is that because of this proliferation, some sort of selectivity has to happen, and it seems like increasingly it's easier not to ever listen to something that you disagree with if you're going exclusively to websites. And this also applies a lot to the current political campaign, these sort of stage-managed appearances to handpick audiences, and no one could argue that candidates were always trying to do that, but new technologies allow them to do it better than ever. And so the ways that this proliferation of information is there is actually quite stratified, and there's a lot of self-selection. So I wonder if we can really say that that information is going to help anyone reach a new understanding, or if it's simply going to entrench our previously existing stereotypes. And I think that this is equally true of people on the left, although I would count myself there, and I tend not to think they're stereotypes. I think that they're well-reasoned opinions. But a set of information. I have a set of sources that I reach online every day, and there is very little chance for me, or very little chance that I will actually go outside of that unless I'm looking for some sort of appalling figure. In a way that, were there four or five papers in this town and there was somebody hawking the newspaper on the corner, I would have to confront what the headlines were. Self-selection. So what I self-select, and also what's marketed to me. I mean, I happen to be in a group that's managed to like avoid being marketed to by virtue of not consuming a lot of commercial media, and by virtue of having sort of this weird under the radar demographic.
Once you have enough money, Sarah. Once you have enough money, you'll be marketed to.
In terms of data mining and communications and technologies, in particular, I mean, getting a little bit away from this, but back to an earlier point. So, I mean, every few years they find a new way to commodify something that you would have thought, like, this is personal, or this is, like, somehow, like, private sphere, this isn't commodifiable. And I think the quintessential example of this at this point in time is Gmail, which is Google's new email service. They give you a gig of space and a tremendous amount of space. A lot of my friends are now pilot beta testing this thing. Basically what it is they have their algorithms go through your email. That's the trade-off. And they then use your personal communications to find out what's best to market to you. So depending on the types of email you send, what you're talking about in your email, they're going to find the products that would be interesting to you. And so private communications then become commodity to be sold. And people are so excited for this because Google has fewer ads, or less ridiculous ads than, say, a lot of the other products out there. And it gives you a gig of space, which is a tremendous amount of storage space. Yeah, they're right.
So now probably the corporate pressures will be more magnified.
They have filed the forms to launch their IPO, right? They haven't actually launched it yet.
I thought it was launched today, but it's going to happen.
Either way. But I think this sort of, I think if we were to try to point, in fact, I think we would be hard-pressed to identify areas that are not commodified or could not be commodified in our lifetimes. I think if we were to just, like, attempt to say, here's an area that's private, won't be commodified, we would actually, as a really intelligent, highly educated group of individuals with tremendous amount of experiences, would be very difficult. It would be very difficult for us to find places where we would say, this is not a commodity. And news is one aspect of that, is one element, is one facet of this, but certainly has been commodified for decades.
I want to throw this back, thinking a little bit about public space and the way that ideas of commodification in public become synonymous. And I have this belief that we don't even really have a cultural concept of what the word public means. If you look it up in the dictionary, it's defined as not private. And we have such an interpenetration of capital with every element of our life, you know, so that when a company goes public, it becomes something that a lot of people can make money off of, or more, arguably. So I wonder, with the applications of that kind of data mining software, it seems like they're either military/intelligence-based or trying to spy on people who might be activists or spy on people who might be terrorists. And they're also for sales. But I, you know, coming from this from an art kind of background or art perspective, there, you know, people have in art done a lot of experiments with how to get rid of any of their private spaces, and share private things with others and create or break down this division between private and public, and also break down the unity of public and commodified, public and commercial.
This dichotomy that you drew between you know, security and war and business and commodity.
Oh,
like,
I wonder if they were linked, right?
I mean, when I view things, there's two aspects of the exact same phenomenon, which is that, you know, there are ways in which, you know, control is established in society and within ours. Like, clearly, you know, corporate consumerist control is foremost in how our society is structured. In terms of public spaces, you see this in terms of, you know, our group of a half dozen to a dozen people, we can hang out here and we won't get harassed.
But we're white.
And, well, but even as white,
and I know all the workers,
folks, like, you get a second group here, they probably wouldn't be harassed, a third probably not, but at some point, the same groups, more of these exact same groups, will become a threat or be perceived as a threat in needing of disbursement, in needing of control, simply by gathering together. This, I mean, a fundamental tenet of our democracy is this idea of association, and yet we give that up regularly at every major protest at this point in time. Without that...
That's really the bottom line of what we're talking about here, is the nexus of media and democracy is power. How do you use media to have power in the democracy? And right now we're in a situation where the media is concentrated, control over messages that the public receives is in the hands of a small section of society, which also happen to control the government. And
it happened to,
you know, chance. Who knows? Which is why they're quite happy for us to create a million websites. But they're not quite happy for us to put 500,000 people on the streets on any given day. They don't want to see that. That's centralization of power. That's getting around the media systems. That's coming out from our living rooms, getting away from our televisions. Just in class this morning, some of us are in. The professor said, quoting another, that if everyone didn't have a television, the government would give one to you. Because you can't govern without a TV. But here are some interesting stats that will shed light on our conversation. Number one is a good half of the American public receive no news media. They do not consume the news media. They consume the news on a peripheral basis by hearing conversations about it, watching late night television where the news is a matter of comedy. Arguably it is. Which is also a situation that those who are in control are quite happy to perpetuate. That's not a threat.
No, they're not coming after us. Sarah, we knew they were coming after canals.
But this is... the fundamental... the fundamental paradox for those of us who want to promote grassroots media to generate democratic movement around communications policy is that in order to compete for power in the current system, which is, I don't even want to call it a democracy because it's not a democracy. In order to get at the table to change things, short of revolutionary action, you have to play the game, which is what MoveOn is doing. And what they're doing is they have identified the fact that you,
in order to know what's going on in the government, a technocracy, a highly specialized set of policymakers making all the decisions, nobody really knows what's going on. You get the spin, the turn, yeah, maybe. In order to combat that, you have to have people in situations and alerting people that your decision is being made. What keeps MoveOn from being spammers is the trust that their members have that what they're being told is accurate. But they're endangering that line of trust. And if they lose the trust of their members, they'll lose members. But what MoveOn does that hasn't been done before is they've centralized the presentation of news to a decentralized audience, just as the mainstream media does. But they have been able to invest the money to sustain the monitoring costs at the governmental level.
That's the difference. It's been done before. Progressive Secretary and lots of organizations did it. And that model was picked up by MoveOn. But I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe what you're saying is true, is that they were able to invest in the on-the-ground kind of, you know, first line of story gathering.
Behind the scenes at MoveOn is every Democratic media hack feeding them information all day long, every day, calling their offices, constantly saying, do you know about this? Read our report, read our presentation, tell your members this is our issue, this is an important decision coming up. So what's going on behind the scenes of MoveOn is an alliance and is a coalition of progressive social groups that, all right, today we're going to talk about this issue, we're going to send a message to our members. It, see, Wes, Eli, Joan, and whoever at the bottom, doesn't mean that they wrote that message, means they've had the final edit, but likely the content, particularly if it's a specialized issue message, was written by an interest group that has expertise in that issue that sustains the monitoring costs for the 2 million members. All of us on our own with our blogs couldn't possibly do that. Not on our best day. So, but then again, you do lose. You lose the grassroots, decentralized power structure. You lose the democracy in who's making the decisions.
Okay. It's an issue of, I don't necessarily think that because you participate in MoveOn or something that you lose your critical edge. In fact, most of the people I know who consume that kind of centralized leftist calls to action are also consuming lots of other kinds of things. And as a result, it's those layers. I mean, the best thing that I ever did in my life was to start reading right-wing media and to start really paying and getting things like World Press Review that, you know, takes one issue and shows, you know, 12 different medias from across, or 15 different media sources from across the world talking about that one thing. So, I mean, I think that that's the ethos that we want to spread. We want to spread the, hey, you know, use the tools that you got to the extent that they work for you, and keep reaching out to, you know, to have kind of multiple tools in which to move and discern between things. But it's amazing. I think it's very similar to the day before the elections. This is what happens. It's so funny in this town. People call me up. Danielle, who should I vote for? Email. Danielle, just tell me who to vote for. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to figure it out. Just tell me who to vote. These are all professors who, like, spend their whole life reading books. You know, like, every week they're reading, like, 10 books, right? The day before the election, they call me up. You want to know what I do? Sick of the call. Send out an email to everyone I know who I think mailing me and say, I'm not telling you who to vote for, voting for, and why, and I do the whole thing, and then I send that out, and people are like, oh, thank you so much, and then they all go and vote, and before we know it, you know, Obama's got 65% in my precinct, and, you know, Kucinich carries the entire precinct.
You're the local
law. And it's like, well, shit, I don't believe in it, but at the same time,
yeah,
it's effective.
And people respond to it.
And it works.
And people respond to that. People don't have time to be informed about the news now. They're
actually a point that's been interesting me, like, the last 5 or 6 minutes that I wanted to make, and it ties into everything everybody's been saying. There's this, they're saying, I could probably walk down to the coffee shop right there and find somebody I know, or I could walk to the other coffee, I could find somebody within 2 blocks of here who I know, and, who is not a political activist. I mean, it just so happens everybody sitting in this circle is, you know, on the left and is politically engaged and active. It just so happens. I mean, how did we get to be here? But if I go to them and I want to say, and I want to talk to them about the Nightline story, that's rude. And they're going to have a problem with that. And if I go to them and I want to talk about Michael Jackson firing his lawyer, that's fine. That's me being a good guy and interesting to talk to. And, you know, the ethic you're talking about that people have to adopt, I mean, one of my favorite news sources that I read every day is the Globe and Mail from Toronto, right, which is kind of one of the banner conservative international newspapers. And I try to read it every day because I want to know what their spin on the news is. And I think that's a good virtue. I think people should have that. But, I mean, first you have to convince people that, and this goes back to what you were saying, that politics matters and it's something worth being concerned about. It's a part of your life. And now I'm going to hook this back to technology. This is my claim. I think this is false, but I'm gonna claim it. So, well, I'm cynical. I deep down, I mean, I do things on a daily basis that are trying to, you know, increase democracy, you know, and try to build democracy in kind of a radical grassroots way. But deep down, I think fascism is right. Because one of the fundamental premises of, you know, democracy is that people want to have a set of conditions of their lives. I become more and more convinced every day that people really don't want that. What they want is to have a reasonably nice life and not to be bothered about all the other stuff.
They need a benevolent dictator.
They want a benevolent dictator. That's what people want. And so talking to them about this virtue of, it always gets me in trouble when I make this argument, by the way, but talk to people about this virtue of being engaged and politically aware is odd to them because that's not what they want. And so now it goes to my false claim. So here's my false claim that I'm going to come up with, that really what's going on is that the way that things are structured, people don't have a chance to be engaged in a way that's really relevant. So if you're a wonk, then it's interesting to you and it's fun and it's entertainment. But if you're not, it doesn't matter. And so what I want to claim is that the kind of the distributed nature of internet technologies, especially as they get cheaper, as you get cheaper ways for people to be networked, offers a way for people to be politically engaged and informed in an effective way that's relevant to their lives, so that, what's the claim here? That they are part of a democratic conversation and they're not excluded from it, and it doesn't seem like just entertainment and not relevant to their lives.
So technology make information fun.
I want to say relevant. I don't want to say fun. I want to say relevant.
What it does is it gives you the opportunity to use the knowledge that you have to good end.
What?
To good end. Oh. You can learn about technology allows you to communicate in a network like your bonds or write your congressman or form a local activist network where you can actually organize people cheaply. You can sustain your own monitoring costs. It no longer requires you to own a broadcast station. It no longer requires you to own a newspaper.
You don't even have to be outgoing, which I think is important. You can actually be a very, very shy person and create a movement and not even be able to interact with human beings in a face-to-face way. Which I found it's this whole group of people all of a sudden enter the activist landscape because they were able to work over email and they're unwilling to work kind of face to face. I just want to throw that in because I think
turn out the vote.
Well, I think another piece of that may open up the conversation.
conversation. Because right now I think that we are a little bit maybe older than we are, or people who are less educated or less... either on, they're seeing you or you seeing them, is that potentially it doesn't matter what you look like, it doesn't matter if you're 8 years old and obese, it doesn't matter if you are a very large black man, people will be filtering your message, theoretically, at least for the content, and not, you know, there are definitely other ways of getting around that, but then does that raise the question, is it simply a matter of access, or are there also things that we lose out on if we move that kind of debate and that kind of participation more and more into the virtual realm? And you had started out in your intro, Danielle, talking about the ways that people interact with you differently over email versus in your living room. And I think you had a third location as well.
In City Council.
Yeah, could you talk about that? I think we're talking
about time. Sure. Although I do want to comment that you're right in both cases. People are fascists, and they're also Democrats with the small d. I think both are true. I think that inside of every single human being is a fascist, someone who wants to be controlled, someone who wants other people to make decisions for them, and someone who tends towards calling themselves a victim or someone who's passive. And there's also a desire in each of us to participate in the decisions that affect our lives. But sometimes people want to participate in what food they eat, but I mean, you know, it's not always on the level of something overtly political. So I just wanted to comment on that, because I've always felt like, yeah, fascism wouldn't have worked unless people tend towards it. I mean, one of the things my mother said when I was a child was, don't forget that Hitler was democratically elected. I mean, she left out the part about how he didn't let any of the Jews vote, but I mean, it was what she wanted to try to get across to me is that we all are a little fascists on some level. But what I had said at the beginning is that my experience has been that at city council chambers, and I know you all who have actually gone, how many of you have actually been in a city hall before and spoken before a council? Okay, Victor, we'll get you a speak. It's an important experience to have. It's very frightening. It's very frightening because the people are up high, especially in Champaign, they're up even higher. In Urbana, we're kind of a little more democratic, so we're a little lower. But it's so funny because they built this table with all the little chairs, and they built the table too high, so the chairs all have to be really high, so all of our feet dangle, even the mayor's. They all dangle. And they dangle, and so the mayor and I are always like sitting on our legs because we can't really, like, the feet are dangling. And I think it's hilarious because I think part of the whole goal was to make us a little bit higher than the public. And so you sit there and there's this table and everyone's a little bit higher than you, and it affects the way you think about it. And so people will stand in front of us and they'll speak, and they're very deferential. The city hall is set up to make sure that the members of the public who come in are deferential, and the architecture commands that. Over email, they're obnoxious, slanderous beasts. They are amazingly insulting, disingenuous, just kind of seat of the pants, crazy shit comes out of their fingertips when they're on email. I have constituents who will be so deferential in City Hall, and then on email it's like the flip side of it, just crazy stuff. And then when they're in my home or we're sitting face to face, that's where it seems like there's an equality there, where they aren't mouthing off, there's a certain respect, but there's not deference. So I'm going to lose my voice, but I think that there's something about the landscape, the electronic landscape, that revokes responsibility.
That does mean is an outlet for the frustration of having to otherwise interact in such a constructed public space.
No, it's the...
I mean, you could argue it's just about frustration aggression theory, right? Like, people go, they're trying to interact in these spaces that are, like, entirely, like, set up to marginalize the public.
Which is absolutely true.
And so they're frustrated, and so then they're just like, well, fuck, like, how, you know, I'm going to go send her an email. And then you get the flip side of that.
I don't think that's true. I mean, I think that that's, I think that people are so frustrated not being generally able to participate in the political process that sometimes that comes out. And I think that we're brought up in a culture that is anti-political. All politicians are slimy. I mean, I'm treated as though I am slime until I prove I am otherwise. I don't know anyone else who's treated that way. Like, I don't know, you know, like if you go in and you're gonna like buy a battery, like the person behind the desk isn't slime until they're not slime. You know, like most people, you know, professors you meet, they're not slime until they're not slime. But if you're a public official, I'm a public official, not a politician. I make a distinction. And I think that public officials are considered slime until they're not slime. And I think that the city hall architecture does not help that. It says, I don't care what you think about me. I'm a little bit taller than you. Or in Champaign, I'm a lot taller than you. But I think email is, I mean, we've seen it even in indie media environments. It doesn't have to do with political officials. It's people who, there's not a sense of accountability. There's not that sense of community where you have to look somebody in the eye. And I mean, this has been all said before, but it's very true, and it affects the way in which we communicate with one another. It allows the shy people to speak, but it also allows people to flame each other. It can be very counterproductive. And as a result, there's not transformation. Though, if you go to IMC, UCIMC.org, you'll see Jack Ryan and Mike Lehman fighting, duking it out. It's like a game that they play, and both of them. And I'm actually disgusted with both of them. I don't think either thing is useful. And I think that the thing is that this could happen for years, and there would be no transformation on the part of either of them. But if you actually got them in the room together and they had to have a discussion in the same room, I guarantee you there would be some transformation, some difference made in that is not made in the landscape of flaming each other in the comments section of indie media every day for 10 years.
I don't really have any way to do that. I don't know if anyone has any last thoughts. The conversation has gone all over the place, and that's what it ought to do. I guess maybe the one thing that I had been thinking about, because I tend to always think of something to say, is the relation of our bodies here with the building. This kind of conversation probably wouldn't happen in the city building. These kinds of conversations that happen in the city building have that architecture going on, or there's a window in between you and the person who's administering what it is that you need. I was struck when I was looking at where to have this conversation in this whole little triangular block, that there weren't any benches. There's about a block up from us, there is a pretty wide sidewalk, wider than where we are now, with the flags of the city of Champaign, the U.S., and the state of Illinois. And it looks like it's meant to have benches at it, but they're not there. And I think that's really, really troubling. And in most of these spaces that we're going to have these conversations and other events, they're not set up. They're just not prepared to host these kinds of things. And so we've talked a little bit about how technology might provide or not provide analogous sorts of spaces, but I think just taking off on what Danielle said, it seems that we still need more physical spaces to have those kinds of encounters. And I think that one of the great failings of my project and of this gathering is that it is very difficult to mobilize people or to energize people or to even get the word out to people who are dissimilar, who don't already know each other, to come and talk. And I have no idea how to do that. I just know how to try. So I'm trying.
Well, I think, in terms of public spaces, back in the Middle Ages you had, what, moats and walls and whatever. I mean, now you have, like, the streets act as moats. You know, you can't have a large mass of people wandering towards City Hall, let's say. You've got these bulwark planters. You've got a huge building with, you know, entrances that are guarded. And then once you finally make it inside, you've got your throne room upon which, like, your officials sit. Like, the actual physical spaces that construct our society, the public spaces, are very akin to what existed 500 years ago. And yet we claim today a rhetoric of democracy and access and public space.
How
one thing to that. The main thing anybody who listens to this is going to hear, besides us,
is
traffic.
Yeah.
And each one of these cars that goes by, every now and then there's two people in it, or three people. But they're these little tiny private spaces that are just... And I wasn't even thinking about this until you said about the way the public space around us is. But, I mean, this public space is really defined by that phenomena of these little individual spaces running by us. And there goes a public one, an empty bus. That's I don't know what to say about that, but...
Too much has already been said.
They're usually not empty, but that one happened.
Then what you have is technology providing forums. Like, we could all be on IRC in the quiet of our own home, and that would be considered, like, the joys of technology, right? Like, we're now no longer...
Or a dating site. Let's turn it off and get the other way.
Right. Or a dating site. But we would be anywhere but here, because right here is actually an obnoxious place to be. Like,
I've actually never been here before, where we are right now. I mean, I'm sure I've walked through it, but I've never been here.
So the actual, you know, the praxis of technologies is really just to isolate further and remove us.
Yeah, praxis and utilize. Without Sasha, his utilization of this and that. Go, Sasha, go. Praxis. Get the praxis.
I'm done. Thanks.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.